Good evening. One of the quietest and most effective of America's humorists is a young middle-aged man, Russell Baker, who was at one time a first-rate reporter on the New York Times. He quit reporting to brood on the human situation. That sentence, I suppose, implies that a reporter is too fenced in by facts and what newspaper men call hard news to spend much time thinking or meditating, which is a kind of floating thought. Well, I didn't intend any slap at the New York Times. On the contrary, the New York Times is one of the few leading newspapers left whose reporters are reporters, not leader writers in disguise or ambitious novelists trying out their imagination on the facts that come to hand. More and more, it seems to me, and most notably in England, you can see the political leanings of a given paper without having to turn to the editorial page. And this is becoming more and more true of conservative papers, liberal papers, leftist papers. It encourages people to do what I believe they shouldn't be encouraged to do, which is to buy the paper that gives you the facts that you want to hear, or a view of the facts that you feel must be so. I think it's a great pity. The difference between this practice and that of the New York Times is strikingly reflected when English friends of mine arrive in New York. To a man, they complain that the New York Times is dull and gray on its news pages. Well, even in its own country, the Times is known as the Good Gray Times. What they mean is that the reporting isn't what they call lively. The Times requires its reporters to see or hear what happened, to check with the people who were involved whether or not they share the reporter's political bias, and to put it all down as accurately and baldly as possible. It seems to me to be one of the greatest compliments, perhaps the greatest, that you can pay a reporter, and that's to say that you have no idea which way he'd be likely to vote. But of course it makes for humdrum reading, unless the facts themselves have been hidden and happen also to be hair-raising, which was certainly true of the facts about Watergate, dug up by the two gray, impassive gravediggers, Woodward and Bernstein, employed by the Washington Post. But I'm afraid their success in exposing a flagrantly dishonest president, unfortunately, encouraged reporters everywhere to lust after a similar fame by digging out not all the facts, but all the scandalous facts in the hope, no doubt, of getting a movie contract and so graduating once for all out of the reporting business. Well, Russell Baker quit reporting for quite other reasons. He was an alert and excellent reporter, but he had a talent for meditation and for whimsy and irony, which got in the way of the gray, bald facts. So he became a columnist, and he's now one of the most prized of the New York Times' stable. And this week was a good time for him to stretch himself, because there's just now an absence, or rather a calculated pause, in hard political news. The conventions are over, the candidates have been picked, but the presidential campaign, it's always agreed, will not fire its first guns until Labor Day, a national holiday, and the official end of summer. Well, in this brief, or you could say briefing period, the staffs of the two campaigners are like Eisenhower's staff before D-Day. They are poring over battle plans, equipping the troops, bringing up the landing barges and the rations of gas masks and peanut butter. But on Monday, September the 6th, boom. In the meantime, the newspapers are also mobilizing their war correspondents. So many reporters to Ford, some detailed from now till November the 2nd, to Senator Dole, Ford's hopeful vice president, Similarly, another body to cover Senator Mondale, Jimmy Carter's Veep. But the main body to stay with Carter, till the election doth them part, or sends them on to the White House. Understandably, there's a larger body gone off with Carter than with Ford, because we all know old Jerry Ford, or think we do, and we know that he's hardworking and decent and pedestrian. We don't know who or what Jimmy Carter is, in spite of reams of profiles and character studies and a spate of funny cartoons. The cartoonists have pinned him down before anybody because his southern origins tempted them beyond resistance to show him as a cornbread Georgia cracker. The best of these cartoons came out several weeks ago, and I'm afraid I have to weaken the punch of the joke by reminding some people that the chicest shoes worn by Madison Avenue advertising men and such tend to be made by the Italian house of Gucci. Well, the cartoon showed, in parody, one of the immortal scenes of American literature. Huckleberry Finn and Nigger Jim on their raft, hailing a passing steamboat, chugging power and smoke. Huck, of course, is Jimmy Carter. Nigger Jim is his vice presidential mate, Senator Fritz Mondale. Carter is waving up to the steamboat and saying, "Hi, y'all, I'm Huckleberry Carter, and this is my man Fritz." And out of the corner of his mouth, he's hissing to Mondale, "Shuffle a little, Fritz." To which Mondale is hissing back, "I can't. I'd scuff my Gucci's." Well, this, of course, is meant to point up the incongruity of having a southern hillbilly for president and an urbane senator as his running mate. It's too easy to be true. Whatever else he is, Carter is not a Georgia cracker or a hillbilly or anything so naive. Homespun, he may have been. But then in their several ways, so were Harry Truman and Lyndon Johnson and Lloyd George and Herbert Asquith, for that matter. What they became was something quite different. All of them highly intelligent, they turned into cool and sophisticated politicians. The suspicion that there is a great deal more in Jimmy Carter than meets the eye of the cartoonists is what has sent that army of correspondents down to encamp close to Plains, Georgia, Carter's hometown, a place of 540 population, no motel, one petrol pump, a grocery store, and several healthy farms. The fact that Carter has cultivated a large and prosperous farm would be simply stated and left at that if his principal crop were not in peanuts, what in England used to be called monkey nuts. And for some reason, known possibly only to Morecambe and Wise, peanuts are a comic commodity. It's going to take time to shake the reporters out of their joyous preconception that Jimmy Carter is a latter-day Huckleberry Finn. Time, the magazine, published a facetious lexicon of southern words and pronunciations we're all going to have to learn if Carter becomes president. The truth is that Carter's speech is a very modified form of southern American English, much less southern than that of Lyndon Johnson, and I haven't heard of anybody, American, English, Scottish, or Australian, who has the slightest trouble in following him. But newsmen are quicker than anybody in pinning a stereotype on a human being suddenly famous. They have to be, because they have to write about him, while everybody, themselves included, is wondering what he's all about. For the time being, and until he starts to declare himself on the issues, these people are busy boning up on what their editors require, namely background pieces. In Carter's case, this means probing into his life and family history and coming up with little shining nuggets of homely anecdotage. It's a depressing process, and sometimes an unfair one. Carter, for instance, has a nephew who has been in trouble with the law, and people wonder if this will affect the outcome of the election. Well, somewhere along the family tree, we all have weak branches, but few of us stop to say, I wonder what the background stories about me would read like if I were suddenly a presidential candidate. And this is what started Russell Baker off on his latest reverie. And for all its fun, it packs a moral, at least a cautionary tale, for all of us. The reporters, Mr. Baker notes, have gone off in battalion strength to Plains, Georgia, to search for the roots of Jimmy Carter. And they made Mr. Baker realize why he'd always shrunk from running for president. He came to reflect on what the press might do to him if they ever descended in force to do its sociological study of my roots. He fears that it would take these ferrets no more than a day or two to unearth the fact that as a toddler, one of my most memorable achievements was the discovery that my Uncle Sims hid his whiskey in a jar behind the barrel of whitewash behind my grandmother's house. Or that my grandmother, on being shown the evidence by me, threw the whiskey on the woodpile and gave Uncle Sims such a lecture that he never touched the stuff again for several days. Well, it seems that Mr. Baker's Uncle Sims is long gone, and, as he says, beyond public humiliation, but I cherish his memory too closely to want to see the story laid out in Newsweek under an old snapshot of him. Apparently this rustic episode happened during Prohibition, when it was a criminal act to manufacture or even possess liquor, whether it was the genuine stuff smuggled into the United States or home-brewed moonshine. Mr. Baker says Uncle Sims, whose only surviving snapshots show him with several days' growth of whiskers, would have inevitably emerged from this publicity as a bum, which he was not. Every male at the crossroads, Baker says, shared his taste for moonshine, while every female spent a good bit of time emptying jars on woodpiles. Mr. Baker also had a friend, the 11th child of a mountain family, therefore called simply 11. Mr. Baker doesn't know what became of him, but he says, I don't want to be sitting before the television some night surrounded by Secret Service men, when suddenly a commentator appears interviewing a man named 11 about my early deficiencies. I'd rather not be president. And so say I, and so I hope say you. Childhood has much more to offer than quaint or disreputable incidents. What went on in the mind of young Jimmy Carter is everything, and that no reporter will ever dig out. As Mr. Baker puts it, at the end, the reporters are fiercely capable fellows when it comes to finding the Uncle Sims of America, but they are not geared for the more important things, like detecting the way a June morning smelled in 1934, or what the wind sounded like in the chimney that December. Good night.